Chapter 4. 221 Baker Street. Baker Street is a busy cut-through between Regent's Park to the north and Marylebone to the south. Its cobbles ringing out with hooves and cartwheels from dawn until well past dusk. It's close to the Underground, which is still running even if the trains are irregular and more jammed than Newgate Prison. Above ground, many of the old townhouses have been converted into shops, cafes and pubs for the commuters hurrying to and from work. In the winter, there's a choice between the biting wind and rain and the inferno below. A few minutes' walk will get you to the old Waxworks Museum and the quacks and snake oil peddlers of Harley Street. Thanks to the proximity of the park, the atmosphere is cleaner than in the more central parts of the city, and the area has less than its fair share of smog, though the braziers of the rough sleeper camps do give the air a faint scent of wood smoke. The park itself was deemed royal once. Now nobody with any sense, let alone a drop of blue blood, would think of walking through, certainly not at night. There would be little chance of coming out the other side. The royal swans, once famous here, have all been eaten. Number 221 stands in a row of almost identical houses, Georgian neighbours that have decided to make a stand against the general decay of the city. Each one of them has three stories of honey-coloured brickwork, and although some of the stucco frontage shows a few cracks here and there, the overall impression is one of elegance and solidity. The front courtyards are well maintained. The brass knockers and letterboxes look as if they have been polished. There are even flowers growing out of the window boxes. Once again, John asks himself how Missy came to be living here. It's an expensive neighbourhood, and he knows what an NHS nurse earns. He's heard of desperate men losing their homes over a game of cards, but he's never heard of a woman winning one. And anyway, Missy is hardly the gambling type. All in all, her home is something you don't find very often in London. It's a nice place to live. While Missy heads towards the building and sets about unlocking the door, John pays for the cab, aware that he's spending money like there's no tomorrow, and just at a time when he's lost the job that was paying only just for tomorrow and the day after. He waits for the change and counts every last penny, checking that there are no forgeries with a practiced eye. Then he crosses the road and walks through the open door of 221. Closing it behind him, he is surprised to see that the letterbox has been nailed shut on the inside, and there is a scorch mark running up the paintwork from the coir matting beneath. "Put the chain on and slide the bolts," Missy's voice comes from the hallway. John does so. The first thing he notices when he turns back round is the smell of the place. Every house has its own idiosyncratic fragrance, and this one possesses the sweet, musky scent of old wood and dried flowers. The second is the sound of chanting that seems to be coming through the wall from the house next door. The hallway is narrow and feels a little cramped. Directly in front of him, a narrow staircase climbs to the next floor. Following the direction of Missy's voice, he walks down the hall to a door on the left and finds himself in a checkerboard-tiled kitchen looking out over a neat back garden. The room is dominated by an oak dining table and a cooking range, which must have retained some warmth overnight because the room is cosy and welcoming. Holmes has already taken the seat nearest the range and is leaning back with his long legs stretched toward the heat. "I'm just making breakfast," Missy says. "What would you like?" "I've already eaten, thank you," John says, "but I wouldn't say no to a cup of tea." "Do you have any bacon?" Holmes asks. John frowns at him. "You had breakfast at the hospital." "But I missed dinner last night, so I'm still in deficit, and Missy only had cheese on toast, so she's probably ravenous. Bacon sandwiches would be lovely. No rinds, thank you." Missy smiles again, laying plates and knives down on the table. She seems entirely unfazed by her new tenant's peculiarities. John sits down at the chair opposite Holmes and fixes him with a disapproving frown that Holmes ignores. Separated from this room by folding doors is a parlour that looks out over the street. A well-worn sofa draped with throws and scattered with bright cushions sits beside a stern leather wingback armchair. Against the wall between them is a bookcase, surprisingly full given the cost of books. There are works of literature by Tolstoy, Charlotte Bronte, and Shakespeare. Autobiographies, Nelson Mandela, Emily Pankhurst, reference books on medicine, and a number of books on horses and racing. There's something missing in the parlour, and it takes a moment for John to figure out what. A fireplace. It should be there, surely, but there's just a flat wall which feels a little too close to the window. No wonder Missy keeps the range going all night. "You have a beautiful home," John says, feeling self-conscious at the cliched phrase. But it's true. The house is odd, the proportions are wrong, but it does feel homely. Or maybe it's the company. Missy is humming as she stokes the range with coal and places a frying pan on the hot plate. "You must be very happy here," he adds. "Not when she's in fear of her life," Holmes says. Missy stops humming. There is silence but for the sizzle of the melting butter. Slowly she straightens up and turns to face him.
"First you tell me what I had for dinner last night, and now you know I've been threatened. How?"
John examines Holmes, perplexed. Who has he brought into Missy's home? But Holmes's expression is one of mild amusement, and John suspects the subsequent long pause is for dramatic effect. "It was obvious you had cheese on toast," he says finally, with the tone of someone delivering the punchline to a joke. "There's a lateral burn on your forearm in the exact spot one would expect from sliding a grill pan in and out." Missy looks down at the small red line just above the wrist, as if seeing it for the first time. "You could have been grilling something more elaborate, but I deduced probably not, as it was clear you lived alone. Anyway, there is the faintest smell of cheese in the air. Wensleydale? Not one of my favourites." Hands on hips, Missy raises her eyebrows dangerously. "And how did you know I lived on my own?" "You had to cook your own supper before the beginning of an arduous night shift, plus no one told you your uniform was inside out." She looks down at the simple blue tunic all the nurses wear. There's not much to distinguish the inside from the outside, but for a small white laundry label that has curled so tightly after frequent washing that it's almost flush with the seam.
"Oh, for goodness sake, it's been like this all night. Why didn't you tell me, John?"
"Sorry, I didn't notice." "You don't say," Holmes mutters. Shaking her head, Missy goes back to preparing the sandwiches. Holmes gets up and moves to a corner of the room where he stands staring at the blank wall. It's as if he's trying to work out why it's there. "So what did I have for supper, clever clogs?" John says, folding his arms. Holmes glances round. "Whiskey," and then goes back to the wall. "What used to hang here?" Now John can make out a square that is almost imperceptibly paler than the rest of the wall. Near the top is a tiny hole where a nail must have been. Missy glances round from the worktop. "A painting of a horse."
"Why did you take it down?"
"Holmes," John mutters, "it's none of your business." But Holmes isn't listening. His hawk-like eyes are fixed on Missy, not so much demanding as expecting an answer. She takes a deep breath. "My husband loved horses. He was working in a stable when he died."
"He was killed by a horse?"
"I really don't think." Holmes gestures at the wall.
"Why else would she take down the picture?" he interrupts. "Was he thrown off?"
"No, it was an accident inside the stable. He was kicked in the head."
"Missy, I'm so sorry,"
John says, relieved that she cannot see Holmes's expression of smug satisfaction as he sits back down.
"It's okay. We weren't together when he died."
There's an awkward silence as Missy lays the teapot and food down on the table. Holmes rubs his hands together gleefully and reaches for the sandwich with the most bacon. John is also about to help himself, but then he remembers what Missy said before they sat down. "Is Holmes right?" he asks. She looks up at him.
"About what?"
"About you being threatened." Holmes's head darts up, interested again. She sighs.
"Some things have happened, yes."
Holmes says, "They smashed your window and put burning rags through your letterbox." He waits for her to speak.
"Tell me everything. What do you think they wanted?"
"Maybe it was just kids mucky about," John says, but Missy shakes her head. She's looking at Holmes in a new light. He may seem eccentric, childlike, inconsequential, but he seems to know things that nobody else does. Suddenly she wants to tell him everything.
"It started with an offer I received to buy my property. It came from a lawyer in one of those posh chambers over in Middle Temple. I'm afraid I tore up the letter.
He was offering me a crazy amount of money for this house. I mean, almost double its value. But I didn't want to sell. I'm happy here in Baker Street. I was happy when I was living here with Finn. Why would I want to move? Where would I go? So I told him I wasn't interested. What happened then? About 2 weeks later, I woke up in the middle of the night and I didn't know what was going on at first. My eyes were streaming. My lungs were full of smoke. I could hardly breathe. I made my way downstairs and that was when I saw that the hall was on fire. I remember standing in the hall and thinking, if I hadn't woken up, I'd be dead. It was as simple as that. And at the same time, I knew there was no way around it. Somebody had put burning rags through the letterbox. They had deliberately tried to kill me. And then, 2 days later, a second letter arrived. I kept this one. She gets up and goes to a drawer in the dresser, takes an envelope, and hands it to Holmes. John notices the name of the sender printed in the top left corner. Sutro Legal Services. Holmes reads it to himself, much to John's irritation.
What does it say?
He asks. Holmes hands him the letter, and he reads it for himself. Sutro Legal Services. The law on your side. Dear Mrs. Hudson, we were very sorry that you saw fit to decline our client's extremely generous offer for your property, which we communicated to you 2 weeks ago. We have heard, however, that since then you have been the victim of a cowardly and murderous attack, and whilst offering you our sincere regrets and wishes for your future well-being, we wonder if this distressing experience may have persuaded you to change your mind. Your home is in a part of London which is, regrettably, full of unsavoury elements. You will be aware that, only recently, a neighbour of yours was brutally killed by burglars. Is this really an area in which a single woman would wish to live? Our client is not only making you a more than generous offer for your property, it is our view that he is providing you with an opportunity to guarantee your own safety. There is, however, a strict deadline on how long his offer can be available to you. We urge you, Mrs. Hudson, to reconsider your position, not only because it is advantageous to our client, but because it is our most sincere wish and our hope that no further unpleasantness will come your way. Should you decide that the location is not suitable for you after all, we will be pleased to hear from you. With kindest regards, Cornelius Sutro. John puts the letter down on the table. Did you go to the police? He asks. Missy sighs again.
What's the point? Mr. Sutro has written it very carefully. There's nothing in there that's an overt threat, and they just say what John did about the window and the fire. Kids.
And they offered you almost twice its value.
John exclaims. He can't understand it.
Yes, it's a very attractive house, despite the oddity of the way it has been constructed. It's in a central position, backing onto gardens and open ground, close to the station. But why the stick and the carrot? The threats and the overgenerous offer?
I have no idea why they should be so interested in it, Missy says. I mean, I love it here, but it's a scruffy old place, really.
It's possible that there's something in the house that they want, Holmes says. Something of value. Do you know the history of the building?
It belonged to Finn, my husband. Of course, he could never have afforded a place like this. He had an aunt who lived here. It was in the family for years. She left it to him before he met me, and I inherited it when he died 3 months ago.
Was his aunt involved in crime?
Not that I know of. Finn was a bit of a rogue, but he wasn't a crook. His aunt was married to a banker and she inherited the house from him.
Why? But Holmes doesn't answer. He's got down on his knees and is crawling about the floor, tapping on the wooden boards.
What on earth are you looking for? John says.
A large diamond, military plans, a compromising photograph.
Aha!
He's found a loose board and, flipping it up, plunges his hand into the gap. After feeling about with an expression of intense concentration, he withdraws his closed fist, then comes back to the table and opens it with a dramatic flourish. A single silver stud earring sits in his palm.
Oh, that's where it got to.
Missy takes it. Holmes sits back down, his brow creased in thought.
Are we near to a bank or to a jeweller's?
It's possible they intended to dig an access tunnel from here.
I don't think so. The nearest bank is much further down.
Anyone of note among your neighbours? VIPs, journalists, politicians?
There's a Polish family in 219.
She points with her thumb. He's an accountant, I think. And we've got a religious group the other side. You've probably heard them chanting. I'm afraid they do it a lot of the time, although I have to say I've got used to it. I find it quite soothing, actually. There's nothing so unusual about what Missy is describing. London is full of sects and brotherhoods, often meeting in single rooms. For decades, the church focused its attention on internal squabbles and, of course, the need to cover up various sex scandals, until the day that someone looked up and noticed that not a single soul occupied the pews. Now it's homemade cottage religions that draw parishioners into their fold, some of them moving into chapels that were left empty and abandoned, others setting up in residential streets. The humble knights, the family of Christ, the kneelers, the Omega group. They all have fanciful names and absurd rituals, but they offer something that the main church had for too long ignored. Hope. They've all been here longer than me, Missy adds. Do you know if they've received similar letters? I haven't asked. Anyway, if someone was trying to scare me, I think they must have given up. I haven't had any trouble for a couple of weeks now. The letter mentions a burglary? Yes, that was Mr. Wellborn at 223. I hardly knew him, though he and Finn were on nodding terms. They'd been neighbours a long time. He was shot in a burglary attempt, and as far as I know, the house is still empty. It's always possible that whoever wanted to buy this house bought that one instead. She gets up. I've got to go. I'm on a night shift again tonight, so I'll need to get to bed. I'll leave the key by the front door if you want to go out, but don't go too far. You're still in recovery, Sherlock, and you're probably not as strong as you think you are. There's food in the pantry and a medkit. John, you will keep an eye on him? I promise you I won't let him exert himself. Her hand rests briefly on his shoulder before she heads out of the door and her footsteps pad away up the stairs to her bedroom. John turns back to the table to find the chair opposite empty.
What are you doing now?
Holmes is on the floor by the range. He has emptied the coal scuttle, laid out each lump of coal in a line, and is examining each in turn. Investigating, as he puts it. Over the course of the morning, he proceeds to tap every floorboard and partition wall, delve into every cupboard, and lift every rug with the sort of fevered intensity that would make John worry about his health if it weren't for the fact that he appears more alive and alert than anyone he's ever known. In fact, his energy is exhausting. John has to chase him round the house to keep his word to Missy, half expecting at every moment for Holmes to collapse with some kind of seizure. It's easy to forget that he had major surgery just a short while ago. How is that even possible? What's he on? Eventually, John decides enough is enough. Holmes, he says, I really think you need to lie down. Now, we need to find you a bedroom. I'm prescribing you 2 hours sleep, at least, and I want to give you a thorough examination. I thought you'd already done that.
This is post-operative, it's different.
There are three bedrooms on the top floor. Missy's is at the front with a view over Baker Street. The door is closed, and John hopes that she is already asleep. She has worked all night at the hospital, and then she has had Holmes and himself to contend with. She must be exhausted. There are two smaller bedrooms at the back. The door of one of them is open, revealing a comfortable space simply furnished with a brass bedstead and a faded satin quilt that, John imagines, might once have belonged to Finn's aunt. There is a mirror on the wall above the bed, a little wooden chair with a cane seat, and a single window with floral curtains. You can sleep here, John says, peering out of the window. The view is of Missy's untidy back garden, a rectangle of long grass and flower beds that need maintenance and, for that matter, flowers. Working all hours at the hospital, she clearly hasn't had time to look after her own property, and her garden is put to shame by the one next door. The religious community has created a perfectly symmetrical rectangle of neatly mown lawns and topiary with two walkways, a rose arbour and some well-placed wooden benches. John notices a figure wearing a grey habit with a hood drawn over his head. He is sitting down, perhaps contemplating some religious text, although it's hard to be sure as he's reading it on an iPad. He realizes that the chanting has stopped. The brothers, or whatever they call themselves, must have decided it's time for a break. John wonders what it must be like for Missy rattling around this old house with its faded memories, her husband gone. He had wondered where she lived, and now he has to admit that this is the last place he would have imagined. It's almost as if she's lodging rather than inhabiting the place. He'd expected more colour, more warmth, more echoes of her own culture. It's still a wonderful house. She's lucky to have it. It's just that she hasn't made it hers.
The next room is just big enough for a bed and a wardrobe.
So narrow that if John were to stretch out his arms while he was asleep, he would hit the walls and wake himself up. It has old wooden floorboards and wallpaper patterned with forget-me-nots.
Holmes has wandered out and is now going back down the stairs to the middle floor, which contains a bathroom and a larger room, looking out over the street, that seems to be used as a box room. Strolling in as if he owns the place, Holmes peers into one of the cardboard boxes piled up against the wall.
He pulls out a crumpled shirt. Even John can work this one out. These are Finn's belongings. I'm not sure we should be in here, John says. Holmes is still pulling items of clothing from the boxes, letting them fall on the floor. Don't you want to find out who was threatening her?
What makes you think it has anything to do with her husband?
I don't think anything of the sort, not without evidence, which I am in the process of looking for. John snatches a deerstalker cap from his hands and replaces it in the box. He can't help noticing a framed photograph on the windowsill. A younger, less tired-looking missy is entwined in the arms of a strikingly handsome, dark-haired man with flashing blue eyes. His shirt is unbuttoned to his waist, and Missy's palm rests on his chest. Holmes appears at John's shoulder, looking at the picture.
A handsome man, he says.
Yes. John can't keep the annoyance out of his voice. I wonder if she's still in love with him.
I very much doubt it.
Really? Then why do you think she's kept the photograph?
John turns on Holmes.
I think you've been busy enough for one morning. You may not remember, but you actually had major surgery only 12 hours ago. Let's get you to bed.
Surprisingly biddable, Holmes allows himself to be led back up to the bedroom with the view of the garden. The monk, or anchorite, or whatever he was, has gone back indoors.
Sit down, John commands.
He hurries back down to the kitchen and returns with the medical kit that Missy left out for him. Holmes is waiting patiently for him when he arrives.
Take off your jacket and roll up your sleeve.
Could it be that someone wants the house to gain access to the underground network below? Holmes suggests, his ear cocked for the sound of passing trains.
It's possible, John says. The Jubilee line passes a little way to the east of here.
Could you roll up your sleeve?
He wraps the blood pressure cuff around Holmes's bicep and pumps it up. Suddenly, the two of them are close together. I know you're concerned about Missy, and so am I, John says. But right now, I wonder if it wouldn't be more sensible to focus your obvious investigative skills on your own mystery.
And what mystery is that?
Well, we don't know anything about you. Who you are, where you came from, how you came to be naked in the River Thames. Did someone try to kill you?
Holmes considers.
I don't appear to be in any imminent danger, but she most definitely is. Her front door was damaged, and a dodgy solicitor sent her a vaguely threatening letter. But the threats have stopped, and in all honesty, the only thing causing her any trouble right now is you. You can't stay here forever, and there may be people in London worrying about you. Wondering where you are. We need to get you back to your family, assuming you have one.
I don't remember any family.
You mentioned someone called Diogenes. Does that mean anything to you now?
No.
You're not even trying.
John takes out a thermometer and slips it under Holmes's tongue.
Now concentrate. See if you can remember anything at all about your life before you woke up in hospital.
Sherlock Holmes falls wonderfully silent while the mercury thermometer does its work. Blood pressure and temperature are both normal, so John takes an ophthalmoscope and peers into Sherlock's grey eyes. The pupils retract at once, perfect black pinpricks surrounded by a filigree of scarlet blood vessels. Everything looks healthy enough, though a blow like the one he received could well have caused retinal detachment.
Close your eyes. Can you see any drifting specks in your vision?
Holmes does as he's told. There is a long silence. It's almost as if he's left the room. His breathing slows down, and he's so still that John can barely make out the rise and fall of his chest. After a moment, his brow creases, pale lashes fluttering slightly.
Snow,
he says softly, and he sounds almost afraid.
So he's not superhuman after all, then. A tiny part of John feels a whisper of satisfaction that he wasn't imagining Holmes's condition when he brought him in. It was serious. They will have to get him to an optical surgeon. You can see snow?
Yes, it's drifting all around me.
You may have a problem with your retinas.
No, it's a memory.
Really? John sits down beside him. It hasn't been snowing here for months. Could you have been in another country?
I can see Tower Bridge through the white.
That must have been during the winter, then. We did have some bad weather.
I'm not dressed for bad weather. I'm wearing grey trousers, and I don't think I've got a coat on, though it is cold.
Grey trousers? John leans forward eagerly. What do your shoes look like?
Though his eyes remain closed, Holmes's head bends as if he's looking into another world, another time.
They're white trainers, new-looking, no scuffs or wear. They could be the same ones the kids were carrying when I discovered you. They look new too.
The grey eyes flash open. Take me to the place where you found me, he commands.
Absolutely not. I think you need to sleep. If you take me back, it might trigger another memory.
Jumping up, Holmes starts pulling on the jacket.
I'm really not sure it will help.
Why not?
You were unconscious the whole time I was with you. You won't recall anything.
But Holmes is already on his feet.
It's worth a try.
Really, Holmes, like it or not, I am your doctor. I really insist you do what I say.
But Holmes has already left the room.
John sits there for a moment, marvelling at his complete loss of control.
Then he follows suit.